You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey, hey, I'm coming back at you from my fly-on-the-call offices after an unplanned week off, just because things have been kind of stressful lately. But I'm so excited to bring you today's episode with one of my favorite bands, Downhaul. They're a band I really feel like I've grown with after the years of shouting to as many people as I can about them as possible. Their debut album, Before You Fall Asleep, was one of my favorites of 2019, and was the perfect culmination of what they were doing with their sound up to that point. But boy was I blown away when I first played my advance of the follow-up, Proof. It's totally different and better in just about every way. Stick around to hear all about the creation of Downhaul 2.0, how they wrote Proof with a different environment in mind, their experience recording with Chris Teddy from The World Is a Beautiful Place and I'm No Longer Afraid to Die, and being a vinyl band. Oh, and in case you missed it, Gordon, Robbie, and I also did a condensed episode of Fly on the Call for The Alternative's final variety stream. We broke down the singles from Proof, and you can check it out anytime you'd like at the link in the show notes. Now here's my conversation with Downhaul. Kind of going back as far as the beginning of the writing process for Proof, I feel like Before You Fall Asleep is, you know, this really great culmination of kind of everything you had done with Downhaul up to that point. And I'm curious, kind of like, what were you going into Proof like thinking? Like, did you feel like you need to switch things up and make something totally different, or did that just kind of develop naturally?
So have you read David Byrne's book, How Music Works?
No, I haven't.
So David Byrne is the singer of the Talking Heads that I have a storied history with. He wrote a book called How Music Works, and the first couple chapters of the book are about how, like, the place that music is performed impacts the music that is written. And the examples that he gives are like tribal drum circles, how those would be performed outside where acoustics are non-existent and you can have all these fast choppy rhythms and things like that. And the opposite would be kind of like Gregorian chants. And those are in, you know, huge cathedrals and things like that, where these long tones are able to resonate and bounce around the rafters of these churches. But you couldn't perform a Gregorian chant outside, and you couldn't perform a drum circle in a cathedral. What does that have to do with my band's new album? We played a show at Motor Co., which is a 500 cap in Durham. And the bill was us, Oso Oso, Future Teens, and Sidekicks. And it was the biggest room we'd ever played. And we sounded terrible. We played awful. None of our moves landed. Nothing we did connected. I don't think we sold a single t-shirt or like made a single fan that night, because we were just really, really bad. And as I thought about it more and more, I believe it's because the first 100 shows that this band played were in houses and on the floor of, you know, there's a brewery here we always play. It's a pizza place in Greensboro. It's, you know, garages and things like that. And the music that we were writing was really just like all four of us playing at one time at our instruments, full volume, like full bore ahead. And whatever dramatic effect we tried to get, it would be like dropouts and Pat sing something or like a bunch of band hits and like, none of those things translated to playing in a mid-sized rock club. None of those moves connected. And in that moment, I was like, oh man, we need to write something that is going to translate better to the venues that we're playing now, which are like small rock clubs, you know? And that is what kind of birthed the different sonic direction of the music that we wrote for this album. And Robbie can expand on that. It's a long answer, but that's that was the exact moment in time when I was like, we need to change something.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good answer. And to add to that, my take on it would be, and I feel like I've seen this out of, and I feel like all of us have probably seen this from our favorite artists and bands over the years as music fans, whenever you read interviews or like hear them speak and they're asked questions like, you know, like, what are you listening to? Or like, who are you influenced by? And their answers are always, and this might be a little bit of pretension, but also it's like, it's always just like, it's so different than the music.
Yeah.
And that's always been sort of like eye-catching to me. And I'm always just like, why are they doing what they're doing if they're listening to, like, an example that I have is Animal Collective, one of my favorite bands. They're like, whenever they're asked what they're listening to, it's always just like the most off the wall, like out of left field stuff. And I'm just like, why are you like, what is going on? How is this translating to like what you're doing? I think for them, they got like sort of pigeonholed into a type of music over the years. And I think for us, we wanted to sort of what, not comparing ourselves to Animal Collective, but in terms of that like trajectory of like being a band for a long time, which we would like to be, I think I would like to avoid that situation where you're sort of stuck making a type of music that you're not as passionate about as, you know, you would like to be. So with that in mind, like, you know, if you had asked me, you know, throughout this whole process of writing and recording, and even like right after Before You Fall Asleep came out, of like, what are you listening to? What are you into? Like, what is like getting you stoked about music? It would not be the stuff that you would put as like a for fans of recommend if you like for Before You Fall Asleep. And I think Gordon and most of the people in our band would say the same. So, you know, I think when we sort of come to realize that, you sort of try and steer the ship a little bit to where you feel the most passionate and where you're really like driving everything that you have into it. And that's, I think, how a lot of the sonic ideas and concepts came about for Proof, where we were sort of doing what we wanted to do and what we've always felt like fit our style, I guess, better. And, you know, that's no like disrespect to like anyone that loves Before You Fall Asleep or like that type of music, but I just think it fits us better to do what we're doing now.
Sure. And what was that kind of like, that process like, you know, kind of chipping away at, you know, figuring out what it was that kind of really scratched that itch for you?
Yeah, so I think what I wanted to do, I wanted to come across less like a songwriter. All of the previous Downhall stuff have been me strumming a guitar and then taking it to the band and being like, I've written this song and here it is. And I've been kind of precious about capital S songwriting. Whereas with Proof, I was a lot more focused on like kind of like building blocks and like bricks. And like, there were a couple instances where I'm usually always lyrics first and then music from there. But there's a couple instances in Proof where like the music ideas came first and like that lends itself to kind of a different construction of a song. And like, I think that I tried to like leave a lot more space for Robbie, Pat, and Andy. Whereas like me strumming the chords historically has been kind of like the backbone of the song. And we tried to kind of like make the spine of Proof like Pat and like what Pat played. Cause there's a lot of times where Robbie and I are playing single notes or like really simple ideas. And like Pat and Andy are the ones who were kind of like the inertia of the music. And that was something that we were definitely like focusing on and like looking at.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the kind of most obvious parts of where the sound change came from is, you know, the use of baritone guitar throughout the album. And that's not something that I've kind of really seen. I don't think many other bands do. I'm curious, like, kind of how that ended up coming into the picture and, you know, how you ended up working it in.
Well, shouts out Reverend Guitars. They have taken great care of us over the years, and they have an amazing baritone that I'm lucky to own. So there are a couple people who are like doing the baritone guitar thing. So Jeff Rosenstock is a big baritone guitar guy. Nathan Hardy from Microwave does a lot of baritone stuff. Chris Teddy is a big baritone guy. And I just wanted something that would break me out of my normal like moves from a songwriting perspective. It would force me to like use different chords and different voicings of chords. And hopefully I wanted to play fewer chords is one thing I really wanted to do. I wanted to strum fewer chords on this album. And a baritone doesn't really lend itself to playing cowboy chords. I still do it at some points, but that's not its strength. And we were thinking that it would really complement. Pat plays a 5-string bass, which is like kind of a nu metal heavy music thing. And like, we get questions about it all the time. People like try to clown him for it. But the 5-string bass and the baritone both have a low B string. So you can really like really get like a low heavy element that doesn't sound like down tuning or drop tuning or tuning to some like crazy metal tuning. You can get these kind of like low tones that actually still sound musical, and not that those things aren't musical, but you can get these low tones that are more natural and to my ear at least musical.
Yeah, if you soloed Gordon's guitar parts on the album, you would be shocked at how simple they are. Like, and it works, it's perfect, because it creates such a vibe and like so much space for everything else to happen that I think it fits everything so perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really was until like today when I had the album on repeat, like pretty much the whole day, that I kind of fully started to, you know, recognize how much kind of silence there is on the album, whether it's, you know, kind of, you know, specifically made that way.
Yeah, that's what we were going for. So it's good to hear that, but go on.
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess I'm just curious kind of, you know, can you talk about the role that plays in the album, both on like the rhythmic side, like a song like Scatterplot or something where there's space within the rhythm, and then also kind of like the atmospheric side, like the outros and the interludes?
Robbie would be a good person to answer that because he's the vibe keeper of the album.
Well, this sort of goes back to like what we were talking about earlier, how the things changed. And I think that it goes to both of our answers to that question, where, you know, Gordon was saying how we were always playing full bore and how, like, you know, if you saw us live, we were just like each playing the same thing over and over, and like our hands were going the same way. And it wasn't interesting to us anymore. And I think, you know, leaving space for reverb trails or, you know, Pat to do something or me to do something or Gordon to do something or the voice to come through clear, I think it just, it sets a tone and a mood that I think is very evocative, and it draws a listener in a way that sometimes just like everyone going full speed all at once doesn't. And I think sometimes like that can sort of blend into the, like, if you're like, sometimes like when you go into a record store and they're just like playing like an old punk rock CD, you're just like, this doesn't even register to me. But I think when you hear something where there's like lots of silence and the use of negative space, I think it just, you have to stop and sort of just like take it all in. And I think it's something that also lends itself to repeated listening, where you at first listen, it might not sound like much, but then when you play it over and over again, you start to hear how things play off each other, and just the resonance of things sort of brings everything out in a way that is really unique. And I think Chris Teddy was the one who sort of like masterminded that and really made that come through in a way that I really enjoy. And, you know, we couldn't have pulled off any of what we did without him and his production and the way that he took everything that we did in the studio and just like, just made it all come together, I think was really amazing. So I think he's a big part of what you're hearing in terms of that like negative space and silence and how it all sort of works together.
Yeah. And one thing with Before You Fall Asleep and all the EPs is like, we were very concerned with the recordings being faithful to how we sounded live. We were very like, as we were in the studio, it's like a little bit on Before You Fall Asleep, just like some piano in a song or two, but we were constantly like, okay, well, is this what my guitar really sounds like? Is this what these drums really sound like? Is this what like, and we tracked live up until this album. And so we were very like focused on sounding, it's almost like this Steve Albini school of recording where like he just puts microphones in the room and you play your songs and that's your record, where we just didn't care about that. And part of that might have been informed by COVID because we didn't play a single one of these songs live. We haven't. We've never played these songs at a show. Whereas Before You Fall Asleep and the even Tornado Season and all the EPs, we were like trying out that material live and tinkering with it and seeing like what we liked and what we didn't, and playing them at house shows, you know, playing them at pizza shops and things like that, and seeing like what got reactions. Whereas this, like, we didn't do any of that, for better or for worse.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned this kind of being the first time you've worked physically with Chris Teddy in studio after he mixed a couple of your other releases. I'm curious, can you talk a little bit more about kind of that experience and how it influenced the album?
Yeah, I think if you haven't worked with Chris, there are probably two things that really like jump off. There are probably two main things you can discern about Chris without working with him. And that's one, that he's very good because his stuff all sounds great. And two, that he's very creative. Because if you listen to World Is and you know that he produces all that stuff, like the level of like intricacy and like arrangements and all that stuff is like just like seismic. Like the amount of things going on in a World Is song is like, you got brass, you got strings, you got however many guitars, you got multiple singers, you got keyboards, you got electronic drums and acoustic drums. So like those two things are apparent from working with Chris. One thing that you would not know about working with Chris if he hadn't done it is how hard he works. Like he would be, we recorded all of Proof in 6 days. And every day we did more than like 12, 14, 15 hours. And we'd leave after midnight. And when we'd get in the next day, Chris would already be there, hands and knees in the live room, like miking a cab or like messing. He goes so hard. I think like the second day he asked if we could take a break so he could pee. He sits down at the computer, like with his snacks, right? And like doesn't take meals. Like he has his like, whatever those vegan cracker wafers were, and then like peanuts or something over here, peanut butter pretzels is the other big one, and he just like goes in, right? And that was something that was eye-opening to me and kind of set the tone for how we were going to do Before You Fall Asleep was like 15 minutes shorter than this album or something like that, maybe 10 minutes, how we were going to do like a 10 plus minute longer album in like the same amount of time or less time, maybe even, and like get it all done at the level we wanted it to. And like, that's the thing that like really stuck with me about working with Chris, not how good he is or how creative he is, because those are kind of self-evident, but like he truly worked so hard in those 6 days.
Yeah. And to add to that, what struck me about Chris, totally agree with everything that Gordon just said, but, while we were working on demos and like the lead up to recording, you know, we were emailing a lot with Chris and just sort of sending him demos and getting his thoughts on things. And one, like he listened to the demos and like had like this long Google Doc sheet of like little changes, like to tempos and stuff that he would make. And like, that was really, really helpful for us in like the tinkering process, like after writing and demoing, we like practiced a lot. And like, so like that was really helpful for us. And then, you know, at one point, unprovoked, I like wrote up a, like several paragraph, like little diatribe about like what we wanted the album to sound like and what our goals were, just sort of like what we had in mind for the songs. I don't know if it made sense. I haven't read it back at all, so I hope it made sense. But I think it did, because, or if it didn't, he was able to decipher it in some way that a lot of the decisions that he made after the fact, like after we recorded, so like as he was mixing it, was stuff that he didn't even really ask us about, but he just did it because he knew that's what we were going for. And I think there was just like a intrinsic level of understanding of what we were going for that was sort of unspoken, but like we just trusted him because, you know, early on we sort of realized that he had what we had in mind, in his mind as well. And so just that, like, just cohesion that we had was so helpful to us, because, you know, we had an idea in our head of what we wanted to sound like, but we're not capable of doing it without him. And so he took what we wanted and just ran with it and made it so, so amazing. So it was just, I recommend him to anyone. And I think he was just a pleasure to work with.
And what were some of those, like, kind of ideas that you wrote down in that, you know, I don't remember how you phased it, but manifesto like thing about like what the core of the album was? What was it that like kind of shined through the most?
Yeah, well, I would imagine that, and I hate this word, but I would imagine that cinematic was probably in there somewhere, just because I just couldn't think of a better word to describe it. And just sort of like, what's that?
You said wide lens.
Widescreen, just sort of like taking what we had. And I think another thing that we talked about with him is that leverage was sort of like a bridge to what we were doing. And, you know, I think you could sort of hear where we were going if you listen back to Leverage. And then if you also like play Leverage like into the first song on Proof, I think you can hear it. It just sort of like flows nicely. And so we're just sort of like, okay, like take Leverage and then just like, you know, turn it up by 1,000, you know, add the baritone, and then just sort of like space everything out and just let everything breathe way more in a much more like cinematic widescreen way. I think that's about what it said in way more words and probably way less sense.
Yeah. And I mean, that kind of like fire in your ass energy recorded in 6 days, you know, spirit. I'm curious, like, how do you think that kind of affected the finished product and like kind of the way that you view the process now?
Yeah. I mean, we don't work any other way. Like everything that we've done has been in less time than we would have liked to have done it in. So we don't know any other way. So when it's like, okay, we have to do this album in 6 days, it's like, well, yeah, that's what we do for albums. Like we did, you know, Before You Fall Asleep in 6 days, we did Turn It A Season in 2 days. The EPs were all 2 days. Like it's just what we do. You know, it was daunting because we knew that we wanted to do more, and then we wanted to just like take everything up a notch. But that's just sort of where the preparation comes in, and that, you know, we demoed everything twice. We practiced, you know, like, you know, 3 times a week for a few weeks and just really hammered out everything. And I just think, you know, Gordon, Pat, Andrew, like they're all just such amazing musicians that, I won't speak for myself, but I think we're all just, we are locked in. And I don't know, and working with Chris obviously made it a lot easier because he worked so hard. And, you know, Gordon mentioned this when we were driving home, and I just didn't, from the studio, that he just like, he really wanted to make sure that we worked a lot harder than we had in the past. And that really hit home for me because we were there until like midnight every night. And it was just a really rewarding experience.
And two like pretty practical answers are that, like, first of all, we don't write in the studio at all. So like, there was no like, what if this part went twice as long? Or like, well, I don't have words for this song. Or like, well, I don't know what I'm going to play. Like every time we come in super, super rehearsed. And the second like kind of practical thing about it is like, we've never, this is kind of what Robbie said, we've never had 15 days to record an album. You know, so like the way we prepare is like very bounded by just reality and the time that we have in the studio, like in a fundamental, like number of hours kind of way. And the other thing is that we didn't listen back at all. Like when we did the EPs and Before You Fall Asleep, like we tracked it live, right? So you would play it and then you'd all go into the control room and listen back. And you'd be like messing with guitar tones and like somebody would go get lunch. And like, we just like, we left the studio with like no idea what the album sounded like, because not only were we not listening back on a micro level, like we weren't listening back to like, okay, well, like that's everything on the first song. What do we think? We would just go right on to the next one. And like really trusted that Chris would bring it all together. But like, we literally just did not spend time listening back to what we had. In hindsight, it was really risky, but we didn't. I mean, we didn't spend time.
Chris was always just like, yeah, just get another take and then it will be fine. Like, yeah, if you just give me more takes, one of them will be fine. And then we don't need to listen back because I will make it, you know, work in the end.
there was never a time where we comped vocals, which is the worst part of being in the studio. And so we always did back when we tracked live, like I'd sing it 7 times, then we'd all sit in the control room and listen for what might be like Frankenstein takes of the whole song. I just like sang for 8 hours. And then he was like, I think I have what I need. On to the next. Like we didn't sit there in the control room listening on the studio monitors. It was just a dangerous way to make an album, but it worked.
Yeah, and how did, you know, how did that affect the, you know, the entire post-production process?
The mix notes were very long. Not that Chris doesn't do an amazing job, but it's just, you know, we know when we get the mixes back that there are other takes of everything. So it's just like if a vocal part doesn't sound right, or if a guitar line isn't perfectly in time, like it's just like, okay, we'll use the next take. And then, so the mixing process was sort of a lot of back and forth with like shared Google Docs and pages of notes on everything. But Chris was great because to Chris's point, like he had everything that he needed. Like he was right. Like if something didn't sound right in the mix, it was just like, okay, swap it out. Get the next, and it wasn't even like a this is wrong. It's like I don't like how, like I wish I sang it a little bit differently. Do you have a better version of it? And he did. So it's like, you know, pick the one that is in tune and then also sounds the best. He had everything, and it was risky, but it worked out.
If you heard the first mixes of the album, I think a lot of people would be like, this is just the album. It's not like we were like, you messed up the whole guitar vision. Or like the panning is way wrong. It was like the second syllable of the word like blank at timestamp blank. Do we have another take of that? You know, and we'd be like, yeah, we do. We're like, oh, like Robbie came off a note a little early on a riff at like 225. Can we hear a different version of that? And like that, the reason we had mixed notes that were so micro like that is a product of not listening back. Which we didn't do because we didn't have time. So if we had like another day or day and a half in the studio, the mixed notes would have been like significantly less, I think, because we would have listened back and picked the ones we liked. But
for sure. Yeah, and I think what you were saying about kind of like your preparation going into the studio kind of makes sense with what you were saying earlier about the kind of, you know, starting to play bigger rooms and realizing that your music kind of needs to be tweaked to fit that. Can you talk a little bit kind of just like where that mentality came from? I think it's kind of an interesting kind of like realistic take on things.
So I think that like, it's like a trope, right? When you talk to your friend who just played a show and you're like, man, you guys were great. And your friend is like, I thought we sucked, you know? And I am that guy. Like we're going back, riding back from a show, and I'm always like overanalyzing the little dumb stuff. And like, I couldn't hear anything in this song. I thought that solo was probably way pitchy. And like, but I think in that we played that show in that room that was like twice as big as anything we'd played at that point. This is before we'd played Broadbeard, I think, Robbie.
Yeah.
Or even then the rooms are laid out so differently that Motor Code felt enormous. And I think that we were all undeniably kind of like, that didn't go great. Like that, like you can look out into the crowd and you can see that you're just like not connecting, right? And like in that moment, I was like, oh my gosh, like I want to melt into the floor. Like this can't be over soon enough. Like, can I turn around and can we just cut 2 songs from the set and like, get done sooner. But I think in that moment, I was like, if we're going to be playing clubs, which is what we want to do, even in the like towns we play on tour, like we need to be a band that sounds better through a house system instead of like people right in your face when you're playing a house show. You can play whatever you want, you know, but just like being in that situation and like wanting to be better and wanting to be a good live band is what really kind of started me thinking what could we do, you know, that would make us sound better in that situation.
For Sure. Yeah. And I mean, earlier I was talking about kind of like all the space on the album. And I think something that I've always kind of associated with Downhole is a certain like lyrical density. But the more I kind of like am thinking about it, the more I think it's kind of like a richness of the imagery that you kind of paint in your lyrics more than necessarily a lot of lyrics. I guess I'm curious just kind of like how you go about your lyric writing approach and kind of how you developed your style.
So I was a latecomer to songwriting, to capital S songwriting. I had been in bands before. I'd been in bands with Robbie before, but it was always music first. And when we needed lyrics, we would just, Robbie's a writer too, we would just like pull from our journals or whatever and just like slap syllables in until we had a melody and that would be it. I didn't start like sitting down with the acoustic guitar and like writing a song until 2015. So like the songs on the first Downhole EP are like my first songs. And you can tell, like the songs on the first Downhole EP. So first of all, I had like a bunch of songs and those were the best four. So that shows you how bad that whole crop of other songs was if like 15, 18 and Driveway made it, right? Like there was some bad stuff in that crop of songs. So that was kind of like my first times I wrote songs. And like, I think you can kind of hear me getting better at it and getting more confident and like kind of finding what my voice would hopefully be over time. But I, for a long time, was kind of like stuck in a rut of like the only thing that really inspired me to write was like romantic situations, right? So there's like, to be blunt, like a lot of songs about girls and early Downhole stuff. And like, it's a little embarrassing like to think back on that, but I was just so green as a songwriter that like, I hadn't got that out of my system. And I hadn't had like the reps and I hadn't figured out how to write about other stuff. And I hadn't like figured out how to put yourself in places other than heartbreak or like missing someone or like resenting somebody. And I think that happens to a lot of people. I think it's, those are easy things to like inspire feelings. And that's what I was writing about for a long time. Whereas Proof, I'm happier about the subject matter of the songs because they're not all just about girls. So like that is something that I'm like, thank God. Like I saw this metaphor online and it was like not putting out new music or like having your most music out that's years old is like being stuck in the clothes that you like wore your first year of high school or something like that. It's like, you're like kind of tethered to what you put out most recently. And even before you fall asleep, I was like, oh my gosh, like I want that to go away. Like I want people to stop listening to it. And I don't know if that's a good answer or not. My process, Robbie, what would you say? Answer that question for me.
Well, I to sort of condense what he was saying there, I think the progression that you hear notably between the two albums is just sort of like a removal of, I don't know if first person is a great way to say it because there are like I and you know, you are speaking sort of like that sometimes on the new album, but they're like grounded and sort of like in the universal and sort of like details are removed in a way that lends itself to listeners sort of being able to put themselves in the situation themselves and have an easier time relating to them in a way. And I think also like Gordon was saying about like, they're not, most of them aren't about relationships, romantic relationships that is. So, and I think like, yes, I you know, most people have romantic relationships, but you know, there's so much of our lives that isn't that, and so much, you know, unfound meaning in that. And I think sort of tapping into that, I think is just a huge level up. Not that Gordon wasn't writing amazing lyrics beforehand, but I think on the new album, you're seeing just a sort of treatise on everything, not so much, you know, this one part of my life. And not only that, but I think it's inherently more relatable because you're taking out some of the details, just like the specific. I mean, you see like on Standing Water, there's like Newport News mentioned, but you know, for the most part, I think it's just the hard details that can sort of space people from the lyrics are sort of removed in a way that can bring people in. And I hope that people sort of notice that and gravitate towards that, because I think it's like a big selling point of the record lyrically.
Yeah, and I mean, I know people won't be able to hear it until the album's out, but I have to talk to you about Barry, because, you know, when it first came on, like when I hit play on the advance, I was like, it's taken aback, but like sucked in so immediately. Like, I love the, you know, dark, spooky, almost kind of like primal vibes of it, and how it kind of readjusts the expectations for the album is. And I would love to hear, you know, about how that one came together and kind of about its place on the album.
Yeah, it's funny. I heard from a friend who did listen to it that he got reminded of Tool from it.
Who was that?
It was Evan. Kill a Cow on Twitter. Shouts out to Kill a Cow. He mentioned Tool and he was like, sorry. And I was like, bro, don't be sorry. Like, I love Tool. I might be unique in our band as the one person that likes Tool, but like, I can hear it. I think that's just, it speaks to that, how different that song is, that like you can hear, someone could say it sounds like Tool, someone could say it sounds like, you know, a completely different band. And I think that sort of springs out of the fact that it's so different than what we sound like usually. But speaking of like towards like the development of the song, I mean, it started off as two different songs. And you can, you can hear it, I think, we're not sure anymore if you can hear it, that it's two different songs, and that there was sort of like the intro and then like, you know, Barry, the song. And it was demoed as two different songs. And always sort of meant to be back to back and to flow as one. But, you know, after the demo process, we sort of realized that it was silly to split these songs up, and that I think it just all comes together much cleaner and more evocatively as one song. So we added a little riff in the middle and connected them and had some through lines sonically, which Chris was a big help with. And it all came together, and I was pretty worried about it. And I don't think everyone in the Downhall orbit was on board with it being one song, no names named, but, and hey, maybe it was the wrong decision, but I don't think it is. I think it was, it was the right decision, I think. So, and I think it came out amazing, and it's really rewarding to hear people say that it is their favorite song. Because it's one that I have a little bit of trepidation about, because it's so different and it's the first song. And like, you could, there are some people that love Downhall that might put that song on and just be like, nah, not for me anymore. I don't like this band anymore. Yeah. So
smart people.
I'm not gonna listen to this. So yeah.
Yeah. So originally, Scott, the divide was right at the downbeat of where Pat goes into that like dun 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 dun, and Andy's playing that dun dun dun, right there is where it was split. So it was like the heavy stuff, and then like the mosh call riff that Robbie plays, and then like the band hits, they're like dun 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 down, bang, track two. So we had like what we were calling like the intro, and then we had Barry, which was the song that was like a nice neat 3:40, something like that, would have been a nice little single. But now we have this 7-minute thing that I'm convinced that a lot of people have like opened the SoundCloud and seen and been like, or like have like clicked on once and been like, and then it goes into this 6-minute thing, right? So like, I like, when I first like looked at this, I was like, damn it, like that's like 13 minutes of music, pretty much uninterrupted, and it's like two songs. So like, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how it lands.
Well, I, for one, love it. And I can't wait for people to have that, like, that first reaction to it.
And that's what I was about to say, that it sets the tone, I think. And it couldn't have been any, it had to be the first song. Nothing else could have been the first song. I think it just, like, and, like, you know, tonally, there are songs that aren't so minor key. Like towards the end of the album, you might not think it sounds exactly like Barry, but I think it was important to put first because it's sort of like, is a tone setter. And just lets everyone know that, like, this is not the same band that you listen to up until now, as corny as that sounds.
Downhill album.
You know, mentioning the 7 minute song into the 6 minute song, just the overall, like, structure of the album is really interesting to me. And I'd love to hear a little bit about how, you know, the sequencing went and, you know, the general, like, molding of the journey of the album.
But you'd never ask. Bobby, do you want to speak on the sequencing?
So, yeah, so I think when we were writing songs, like, the first few songs that were coming out were, like, Barry, Eyesight, Standing Water. So, like, and when you look at the album, like, those are all in different places. But we did, as we were writing songs, we had sort of songs that we knew wanted to be back to back. So we had, like, you know, like when you're making a puzzle, you have, like, pieces that are all put together. And then, you know, over time you have, like, okay, like, this chunk over here goes with this chunk. So in that respect, like, the sequencing of the album is very deliberate, and it wasn't Before You Fall Asleep as well. Like, that was something that we went into the studio with the sequence already made up. And same thing with this one. You know, everyone in our band loves records and collecting vinyl. And so we put a big emphasis on that listening experience. And so, like, to that point, it's sequenced. We came into the studio sequenced the songs ready for vinyl. So we knew that Circulation was going to end side A, and that Standing Water, like, that very punchy opening. Curtains. Yes. Curtains end side A, and that Standing Water opens side B in a way that really sort of, like, hits you in the mouth. And I think that was very deliberate, and I think it works perfectly. And we knew that that was going to be a good, like, opener, but not so much the album, but on the, you know, the second side of the album. And then, like, sort of zooming out a little bit in terms of the sequence, one thing that I enjoy about the album, and that I think was sort of deliberate but not so much, was the way that, you know, Barry starts off very minor and dry, not so much, and then Scatterplot is sort of a minor song, Curtains is darker, and then sort of over the length of the album, the tension in the songs sort of peels back a little bit and things open up and they breathe even more. And, like, sort of by Eyesight and the closer, it's a very, like, breezy in a way, sort of feel. And I think it sort of gets more hopeful in tone, and I don't want to say happy, but more just like, I just think things open up in a way as the album goes that it's sort of like, you can sort of, like, ease back a little bit, and it's not so, like, dense and in your face. And I think that works really well over the course of the album.
Yeah, it has, like, a trajectory that's supposed to feel like taking something and, like, dwelling in it and then kind of, like, releasing it.
You mentioning kind of the vinyl experience as something that you had in mind is something that really appeals to me as well, because I'm a huge collector. But like, I love the way that that also, you know, plays in with, like, the album artwork and even, like, the limited variant that sold out the first day. That kind of, like, going along with the artwork very well, looking like that kind of, like, headlights through the fog. Can you talk a little about kind of, like, the art direction of the album and how it kind of, like, backs up the darker sides of the music?
Yeah. Thanks for mentioning that. That was, like, a huge thing. So
this is Robbie's victory lap on the art. So everybody we've talked to has been like, talk about the art. And I'm like, that's all you do.
I would say, like, the music comes first always and forever. But it is important to me, and it's important to all of us. And I think it can like buttress of, like, a album experience so much. And so, like, I really wanted to make sure that, we all really wanted to nail it. And just sort of, like, along the theme of leveling up, I think, you know, the album art before was all amazing. And, like, all the artists that we've worked with have been really great. But for this one, like, you know, after we tracked it, and even, like, as we were starting to write songs and sort of get everything, you know, worked out in terms of sequence and what was going to happen on the album, sort of like the picture of what we wanted. And this was informed by like the lyrical content as well. We started to have images in our heads about what we wanted the art to look like, and not even like we wanted a guy standing in front of a car with headlights. Like that was not like the idea. But it was just sort of like, you know, moods and sort of like colors. And I was scouring blogs and art websites for days and weeks, 80 page deep on art blogs, looking for something that like clicked, and like Googling different words, and nothing was really coming up that really fit. And then I stumbled upon the artist who is from Norway, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing the name right. I should have looked it up. It's Øystein Aspelin. And he had the series, and you know, we grabbed a few that we liked from it, and weren't able to sort of like figure it out off right away. And sort of, so I sort of moved on, and we started trying to figure out different, you know, we were in like the local newspaper here has like this online archive of photography. And so like one day, like me and Gordon were on there like scouring for something that might fit. We had a few that we liked, but nothing really ever clicked. And towards like the very end, we came back to Øystein and his pictures, and we're just like, nothing else is making us feel the way that this makes us feel. And then so we were able to make it work. And then we asked, you know, our friend Max Stern to put the layout together, and his work with that, just like, as soon as he sent us what he had, I was like, that's it. There's no other, like, that is exactly what I had in my head. He nailed it. Like the combination of Max and Øystein together, like the packaging, like the back cover is amazing. When everyone sees it, I'm really excited for that as well. Like, I just think it all works together and fits the music. And I couldn't be happier with the way it turned out. So big shouts out to Øystein and Max.
Awesome. And then I like to wrap up every episode the same way, which is just by asking for a piece of advice or something you've been thinking about lately, you know, about music or life or whatever else is on your mind.
Yeah, well, I have a good one. I have a puppy, and I got a quarantine puppy, which was an interesting decision that I made. But, you know, and I've ended up in with my therapist talking about it, just because it's a very hectic situation. And there are times where you get really aggravated with the puppy, and not aggravated with all things in life that aren't puppy related. And one thing that he told me that really resonated with me was that, like, if you're ever in like a really hot situation, just like just go into slow-mo mode, where you're like moving at like a glacial pace. And it might not, you know, manifest itself in you actually like moving slowly, but if you try and like get your mind in that space, that you'll end up sort of like not getting so worked up. And it worked for me a lot with the puppy. So I've tried to sort of bring that into like, if I'm really hot about something at work or something like that, just sort of going in slow-mo mode, it just really helps me. So that's something that came to mind when you said that.
So this is one thing that I like was talking to Max Stern about today. And we were talking about how it's so easy to like not count your blessings and like lose sight of all the things you do have. And the quote, I forget who, was one of those philosopher guys, Euripides or something like that. But the quote was like, remember the times you wanted so badly the things that you have now. And I'm just like so bad at that. I'm constantly thinking about like what I want and like more and more that I want, and I feel that I'm entitled to or I deserve or I've earned, that I forget to like dwell in the things that I am so lucky to have, like health and a job and friends who love me and things like that.
Awesome. Very, very well said, for sure.
I like his answer better.
And is there anything that we haven't hit on that you've been really looking forward to getting out there about Proof?
So I think for both me and Robbie, and this is like a little bit rooted in our answer about being like a vinyl band, like neither of us wanted to pick singles for this album because it feels like you make this thing, right? And like, we want to just put it out so bad. We were like, let me just tweet the Spotify. Let me just tweet the SoundCloud, was what we kept saying. I'll tweet the SoundCloud right now. because like picking singles for us feels so unnatural, and like especially with this album, right? Like picking singles felt so antithetical to like what we were trying to do and like what we cared about. And like, so I'm just excited to finally have the album out and so that people can listen to it hopefully all at once. Like, we're not a Spotify band, we're not a playlist band, we're not a like, we're not one of those bands, we're a band that makes records. And I hope that, I'm glad that people will have the chance to like receive it as such.
Wasn't that just so much fun? I know it was a blast for me. Please go give the new Downhall songs a listen ASAP, or at least make a note to do a full run through of Proof on May 21st when it's released. Whether you've heard the band before or not, it's totally new territory, so I really think it's something you're not going to want to miss. And tweet at me when you do, I'd love to hear what you think. Fly on the Call is brought to you by Sound Talent Media. A special thank you as always to The Alternative for helping to promote the show, Kaylin West of Tiny Stills for the theme song, and Michaela Jane for the artwork. You can keep up to date by subscribing to the podcast and following the show on Twitter and Instagram at Fly on the Call Pod. Feel free to email any questions, comments, or other feedback to me at flyonthecallpod@gmail.com. To quote one of my favorite Downhall lyrics, if you won't admit you're struggling, then no one knows to help you. Let it ring out.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.